I'm joined by Ken Keeble. Ken, welcome to Dialect.
Hello, Tony.
Give us an idea how you personally got involved in the struggle against apartheid.
Well, after the Rivonia trial of 1964, when Nelson Mandela and most of the leaders of the African National Congress were jailed for life, all the remaining members virtually all had to go into exile, and they had a problem then of how to carry on the struggle inside South Africa and to prove to people that the struggle was not over, that the ANC was not defeated.
Tell us about that trial. Can you just remind us when what it was about and when it happened?
Well, it finished in 1964. As I say, it lasted a long time. I forget how many people were involved, a large number. They'd all been arrested at the Rivonia farm just outside Johannesburg, where they were beginning to plan the armed struggle, having failed after many years with peaceful struggle in South Africa. All peaceful options have been closed to them. They were met only with violence, so they had to turn to violence, and this was the trial.
Well, one can understand why any government would be rather worried about people who were meeting to start an armed struggle against them.
Well, indeed, but they've been committing violence against their own population for many, many years. That was their only form of struggle, almost, and it was only with great difficulty and a lot of heart-searching and great hesitation that the African National Congress turned to armed struggle after finding no alternative. They were not up against a democratic government. They were up against a government which denied the vast majority of its people the right to vote. So it was not a legitimate government in any sense. Anyway, the way I became involved was that a small ANC group based in London hit upon the idea of recruiting white non-South African people who had no connection with South Africa, and they had various ways of doing this. Some of them were recruited at the London School of Economics, students who were engaged in a lot of left-wing activity at that time, but the main source of recruits for the ANC for this purpose was through the British Young Communist League. Now, I was born in 1945 into a communist family. Both my parents and most of my aunts and uncles were communists, and so I joined the Young Communist League at the age of 13, and in 1967, when I was 22 years old, I was approached by London District Secretary of the Young Communist League, George Bridges, and asked if I was willing to do something like this, to go to South Africa secretly to help the struggle there.
Okay, before you tell us about South Africa, what was the Young Communist League? Sounds a bit like the Cub Scouts or something. What actually was it all about?
I think the minimum age was 13, actually, or 14. I think I joined just before I was 14. Well, it was the youth wing of the Communist Party, and it was about fighting for socialism in Britain and worldwide, and in a struggle led by the working class to achieve a socialist Britain. And for me, because I was in a communist family, joining it was rather like a rite of passage, part of growing up. And so when I was approached, I'd already been in the YCL for quite a good many years, and when I was asked to do this in a very cautious way, my first thought was that I felt very honoured that I'd been asked. Very honoured I've been selected for that task. Secondly, I felt that that I was well suited for the job, that all my previous upbringing and study and experience, discussion of politics, had all prepared me for this sort of task.
So talking about socialism, I mean, at the time, of course, back in, I suppose, the 1950s and 1960s, socialism was seen as something fairly normal because we'd had a socialist government, a Labour government, after World War II that had nationalised a fantastic amount of things. I mean, you know, various things like transport, things like they even were going to nationalise land, and then they decided to nationalise planning permission instead. So the permission to build was nationalised. What was the sort of, I mean, you say you wanted socialism, but what was the sort of the kernel of the politics behind the communists?
Well, the main idea is that instead of the capitalist class being the ruling class, the working class must become the ruling class. That's the main thing, that the state must, instead of acting on behalf of the super rich as it does now, must act on behalf of the working class. That was the main thing.
Do you
I don't regard the the left-wing Labour government of, the, of 1945 onwards as socialist, and in the different meanings of the word socialist. It was left-wing, yes, it was better than we have now by a long way, but it didn't actually overthrow the rule of the capitalist class in Britain and replace it by the rule of the working class, and it sided with the United States in international affairs, which was its downfall, really.
What are your thoughts about? I mean, we will talk about South Africa, I promise you, in a minute. But you know, what's your thoughts about the way that the New Labour and the modern day kind of version of the Labour Party, which originally was a socialist ideal, and how that's developed now? Because we've got this situation with the super rich who are getting tax breaks, and bankers, and yet people with nothing, and also people like the mentally ill and disabled people are being cut off from their benefits, or at least they're being pushed into a situation where they're supposed to be looking for work when there's less and less work around.
Well, the tragedy of New Labour is that really it adopted Thatcherite economic policies, basically. I mean, when Margaret Thatcher was asked what was your greatest achievement as Prime Minister, she replied, New Labour. And that's the tragedy of the Labour Party. And unfortunately, the Labour Party now is still not, or at least its leadership, is still not broken away from that basically Thatcherite or Reaganomics approach, what was commonly called neoliberalism, in which everything has to be privatised, everything has to be driven by the profit motive, unions have to be very, very, very limited in what they're allowed to do and so on, smashed if possible, and so on. That's the tragedy of the hole we're in now. We have three different political parties who are basically all wedded to the idea of neoliberalism or Thatcherism.
Okay, so tell us. Okay, let's go back to the 1960s again, and your mission, I suppose it was, and in your call, you were called to go to South Africa.
Yes, well, I went on two missions to South Africa. The first one was in 1968. I travelled to flew to Johannesburg. I never flown before. I flew to Johannesburg with a false-bottom suitcase containing 1,200 letters, which were addressed to members of the Indian community in South Africa.
How old were you?
I was 23 at that stage, just 23. And I had to book into a hotel, buy 1,200 stamps, stick them on the letters, and post them at different places all around Johannesburg, so they weren't all in the same pillar box, so to speak, and then fly home. And nobody knew that I'd been, except the man who'd sent me there, which was Ronnie Casserels, who later became a minister in the post-apartheid government. He was responsible for the whole operation. Nobody else knew at all. None of my family, nobody. And my second mission was in 1970, when Ronnie asked me to recruit somebody to go with me, because it was two people, and I recruited my friend Pete Smith, who originally came from Southampton, also a member of the Young Communist League, and we went to Durban. And what we did there was we planted a number of devices called leaflet bombs, which were actually invented largely here in Bristol by Dr. Ron Press, along with others, but he played a big part in it. I'll tell you about Ron Press if you want to hear.
Well, yes, it'd be nicer. What is a leaflet bomb? Yeah, is it dangerous?
Not at all. Nobody was ever harmed by one of our leaflet bombs. One policeman who happened to be standing beside one when it went off got his uniform blackened slightly, but that's all. They weren't designed to harm anybody
Hang on,
at all.
He's got a black uniform, hasn't he?
Well, he was a South African policeman. I don't know what uniform he had. But he might have had khaki shorts for all I don't know. But anyway, it's Dr. Ron Press, who worked as a lecturer here in Bristol for many, many years, played a big part in designing and testing these leaflet bombs. In fact, he tested them on a bit of waste ground in Bristol and also took them out into the Somerset countryside to test there. He accidentally set fire to a hedge. It's a plastic bucket concealed inside a carrier bag. It has a small, very small firework-type explosive charge at the bottom connected to a time switch on the outside. The bucket is filled up with leaflets, and on the top there's some little notices and things designed to warn people away, not to get too near. But it was only live for a few minutes, so they would have had very little time in which to interfere with it. But you take it, you set its time to when you want it to go off. You take it to the place where you want it to be, which would be a place crowded with lots of African people out there, usually in the rush hour on their way home. And you just give it a few minutes for your getaway time, and it goes off and it blasts these leaflets high into the air, and it had an electrifying effect on all the people, because it told them that the ANC was still alive and kicking, gave them hope, it brought them messages of what was going on around the world in support of the struggle of the people, and so on.
Sounds a bit like these sort of propaganda leaflet drops that the Americans did over Vietnam.
You could compare it to aircraft, a similar type of thing. Politically, of course, but in another sense, you could.
What about the languages? Was it just English it was in, or was it in other languages?
I couldn't tell you. I think I might have been shown one of the leaflets, but I can't say honestly.
Okay.
The other thing we planted at the same time, to go off at the same time, was a street broadcast, which was a cassette player, and I'd never seen a cassette player before either. It was the latest technology. It had 15 minutes of silence, which was getaway time, and then there was a song, the ANC anthem, Kosi-Sikelel' Afrika, followed by some speeches and some more songs. And this started off with the electrifying words, "This is the African National Congress. This is the African National Congress. This is the voice of freedom." And that's what people heard.
Almost like your version of the kind of "this is the BBC" kind of, you know, well, sort of something else, but completely.
But this had a really tremendous effect on the people. They went wild. Yeah. And what I didn't know at the time, because you only told things on a need-to-know basis, was that this was done in five cities simultaneously, all by people from London, all by white non-South African people sent from London. And in fact, similar actions took place every year from 1967 to 1971. There were other events later on also, but the two things that I did anyway were the 68 and the 1970.
Can you just give us an idea what South Africa was like during that period?
Well, yes. I mean, the oppression and the injustice of that apartheid society was utterly obvious. You couldn't miss it. And it wasn't hidden. That's the thing about it. It was blatant. And you could see it in the body language, the way people talk to each other, the way all the menial jobs went to the black people and all the white people seemed to be in charge of something and so on. It was obvious. Mandela tells a story in his book Long Walk to Freedom, how he was when he was one of the very first lawyers, black lawyers in South Africa, and on his way, when he was going about his job, a white person could stop him in the street and say, "Would you go across the road and get me some cigarettes, please," or something, send him off on some errand, because every black person basically just could be co-opted like that to do a job when somebody needed them.
Incredible.
Yeah, absolutely humiliating and ridiculous. But you could see it totally. People would offer to do things for me just because they were black and I was white. And it was just that was it. It was very, very unjust, and it was obvious.
Now, recently there's been a book out, hasn't there, about this. What's the title of that, Ken?
Yes, I edited the book, and I compiled it and researched it. It's called London Recruits, The Secret War Against Apartheid. Now, the reason we call it London Recruits is not because all the people in it were Londoners, because they weren't, but although many of them were, but Ronnie Kasriel was the ANC official who sent us off on our missions. He published a book in 1993, it had a chapter called London Recruits. He gave it that name, in which he described in a very limited way this episode in which they recruited these white people. His book was called Armed and Dangerous, My Undercover Struggle Against Apartheid, and that had that one chapter called London Recruits, and that's where we got the name for it. And it's an apt name, but it was really the London unit of the ANC which recruited people from various parts of Britain, including and from Ireland indeed, and elsewhere.
Were you actually committed to a peaceful struggle, a sort of Gandhian type thing, or were you shooting people?
I certainly didn't shoot anybody at all. I've described to you what I did. I planted leaflet bombs and I posted letters.
Well, what about Ronnie?
Ronnie, yes, he was involved in the armed struggle. He was later became head of military intelligence for the African National Congress. Yes, he was indeed engaged in armed struggle. And some of our London recruits transported weapons and helped ANC fighters to enter South Africa. They did a whole variety of things besides the little things, the things that I've described that I did. The thing is that everybody kept it secret all their lives. They just moved on, you know, and didn't talk about it for many, many years. Or they told a very few very close family members, but nobody else. And so the story remained untold. And when I reached the age of 60 in 2005, I decided it was time to write the story of what I'd done. And then when I'd done that, I thought to myself, well, I know there were others who did similar things. I don't know much about who they were, what they did. I know there were others. I'll try and track them down, get each of them to write their own story, put it in a book, and it'll make a very interesting book. And that's what's happened. It's a very interesting book with 32 chapters and all written by different people.
Okay, Ken, we'll talk about the book a little bit more after some music.
Rocking. Oh, mes amis, on ne choisit pas son destin. Les choses se ressemblent, ne sont pas les mêmes. Les droits de la main ne sont pas tous égaux. Dans ce monde, on est complémentaires. Oh, come on, show me everything that you know. I wanna travel every inch of your curves. En Afrique, y'a la canicule. Y'a le soleil, la chaleur.
Armando and Mariam from their album Welcome to Mali, with the song there quite obviously titled Africa. Joining me is Ken Keeble. You better actually spell your name, Ken, because it's if people are interested in getting hold of the book, how do you spell your surname?
K-E-A-B-L-E.
K-E-A-B-L-E. Now tell us what's in it, because you've obviously got some fascinating stories of these little operations that were done in total secret, but you're only now really, a long time after, 30, 40 years after the event, pulling together what actually happened and finding out some of those individual stories which have been secret for several decades.
Yes, it's quite a unique and amazing book, and incidentally I don't make any money out of it at all, because all the royalties going to a South African charity called the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund. So we're not making any money out of it at all. Well, three of the people in the book are actually being presented with medals this week in South Africa by President Jacob Zuma for their role. These were people who actually were arrested by the regime and tortured and they were based in London, and they suffered greatly for what they'd done. Alex Mumbaris, I think he was on his fifth or sixth mission to South Africa. He and his wife Marie-José, that was her first mission. She was French. Is French, I should say. They were helping some ANC fighters to enter South Africa by land, and they were arrested, were tortured. Marie-José was pregnant, and there was a big campaign building up in France for her release, and so she was probably too much of an embarrassment to the regime, so they released her after a few months. But she was very badly treated, and Alex was sentenced to he was also tortured, but he was sentenced to 12 years in prison. But he actually escaped after 7.5 years, along with two white ANC members. The three of them manufactured 14 wooden keys in the prison workshop, replica keys, and they used those to escape after he'd
been
in prison.
Wooden key? I mean, a wooden key isn't surely not going to do the job that a proper key would do.
Well, I imagine it wears out faster. But these one of the ANC members had been a locksmith, and they knew what they were doing, and they had plenty of time, of course, to make these keys, and that's what they did. They made the keys, and on the night when it was the most favourable time to get out, they got out, and they had smuggled some money into the prison, hailed a taxi, and they got away. Remarkable story. A book has been written about that by Tim Jenkin, one of the two. So that was Alex and Marie-José, and then they were arrested in the spring of 1972. Sean Hosey, who was born in Dublin but brought up mainly in Coventry, I think, he was also a member of the Young Communist League. I knew him. He was in the same branch as me, in fact. And he was arrested in October of 72. He walked into a trap. It was his second mission, and the regime had captured an ANC member and forced him, a black comrade, forced him to send a message requesting some documents and some money. Sean was given the job of bringing this over to him, and he walked straight into a trap, and he had a very bad time. He was 13 months awaiting trial, kept in solitary confinement, and then he did 5 years under the Suppression of Communism Act, and he served that to the day.
The Suppression of Communism Act, can they have that? Because, you know, surely the communism or the communists are at least a legitimate political party. They should at least be allowed to be a political force of communism in any country.
Well, in South Africa they were banned, and any activity associated with the African National Congress was regarded as communism. The government tended to conflate the two. One of the ways in which the government and the regime got some support from the West was on the basis that, of course, it was fighting communism, which it was.
No, I mean, one of the reasons for all this is Britain, isn't it? Because it was originally a British colony. Of course, the Dutch fought for independence from Britain. But, I mean, tell us a little bit about the history of South Africa.
Well, yes, it was, as you say, a British colony, and Britain introduced Britain had legislation in 1909, the South Africa Act 1909, which set up this new thing called the Union of South Africa, and gave it a parliament on a racist basis, and that created the foundation for the apartheid regime.
So are you saying that only white people could vote or something?
No, in the early stages, the so-called Cape Coloured people had a right to vote, but they only had a right to elect people, white people, to represent them. So it was a whites-only parliament. Later on, their right to vote was abolished as well. But at that stage, some of them had a right to elect white people to represent them. But it was a whites-only parliament, and only a whites-only parliament could have enacted the apartheid laws, which came in the 1940s onwards.
Now, I know it was a very rich area in minerals and that sort of thing, and things there were... Tell us about some of the characters. I know Cecil Rhodes was famous, as he was even... his name was used to name a country, Rhodesia. Yeah. Tell us about some of those characters who were out there sort of grabbing all these minerals. And, I mean, the thing is, of course, about the mining is that is still a problem, isn't it?
Well, yes, it's
the extraction of those minerals is causing oppression in itself.
Well, yes, it doesn't have to. You can employ people to work without being without oppressing them. But anyway, that's part of the problem. And gold and diamonds and so on. And this was the height of this is the heyday of the British Empire, really. But the point is that Britain introduced institutional race discrimination into South Africa. That's the point. And the thing that justified all our actions, I believe, is the fact that apartheid was a crime against humanity, and Britain was up to its neck in that crime. That's the point. We weren't interfering in another country. It was nothing to do with us. we were involved anyway. Every British person was implicated in the crime because all the main British companies had their subsidiaries in South Africa, which operated the apartheid system, discriminated against their staff and customers on a racist basis, and collaborated with the regime and funded it. The City of London was investing heavily in apartheid and profiting from it, from apartheid South Africa, and the British government was giving diplomatic protection to the regime through the UN and so on. So Britain was up to its neck in the crime. So we were all involved anyway, and the fact the British economy was being subsidised by the artificially cheap labour of the South African people. So that's what I think justifies what we did, and every British person was involved on one side or the other, really, though they may not have realised it, of course, at the time.
Can you sum up then some of the feelings that you have now about the time that you did in South Africa, those operations, and the actual what is actually ultimately a success, isn't it? I mean, there's been the overthrowing of that original apartheid regime.
The left has had a lot of failures and non-successes, but this is one of our successes, yes indeed. Yes indeed.
And what lessons do you think there are for today's generations that you've learnt from that?
Well, international solidarity works. International solidarity can indeed be effective. And I think the fact the need for international solidarity is greater now than ever. I think we particularly need to have solidarity with the Palestinian people struggling for their national rights. And once again, Britain is up to its neck in the crime of supporting Zionism and denying the Palestinian people a right to have a country of their own, which they were guaranteed by the United Nations.
Of course, the Foreign Office would say something very different. They would say that they're trying to be balanced about what they're doing in the Middle East and trying to make sure that they are moving both sides towards a peaceful conclusion.
Well, nothing balanced about what the British government is doing at all. No, they're completely reneging on their responsibilities as members of the United Nations.
For example, they're criticising the Israelis this week for introducing what they've said is 3,000 new settlements. So, I mean, they are criticising the Israelis even if they're not actually sort of closing down embassies or anything like that.
Yes, but Britain, through the European Union, grants a very, very favourable status to Israel for economic purposes. It practically treats Israel as a member of the EU for trading purposes. So it gives it very, very favourable, great deal of help, economic help. And Britain has very, very recently voted to continue that status, special status for the relationship of Israel with the EU, despite the fact that it is supposed to be conditional on Israel improving its behaviour. In actual fact, Israel is breaking many, many, many international laws and adopting a policy of genocide, actually, towards the Palestinian people. So I think that's an issue. Still, we're getting away from the South African thing, but no, I think it is very, a comparable struggle, and I think international solidarity is a wonderful thing. I think the book that I've compiled, I mean, I didn't write it, I've just got the stories together. It's a very inspiring story. I hope it will inspire people to take up international solidarity and to fight for a better world. The defeat of the apartheid regime, in which we played a very, very small part, but it was done mainly by the South African people themselves, struck a blow against racism not only in South Africa but all around the world, especially in Britain, which has very close relationships with links with South Africa. And so that's paid us back for what we did. That's paid us back for it. Britain is a less racist society than it was at that time. And I think when you perform an act of international solidarity, you help make Britain a better place, you help to make the world a better place. You don't just help somebody in a distant country to overcome an injustice.
Ken, how did that racist regime manage to carry on? I mean, surely not all the white South Africans were really supporting it, and many of them didn't support it. How did they manage to maintain power with this sort of semblance of democracy when actually what was going on was a hideous racist, almost like a dictatorship?
Well, it was a dictatorship, and most of the whites did support it. There are heroes among them who did not, of course, and who opposed it, but many did. But the thing is, it had the support of the Western powers, of Britain and the United States, and that's very, very important. It couldn't have done it without. I mean, if the City of London had just said, no, we're just going to pull the plug on you because you're wrong, you're immoral, it's racist and we're against it, I mean, they wouldn't have lasted a day. It wouldn't have lasted a day without the trading links.
What about today, though? Do you think there are comparable struggles going on now?
Well, I've mentioned one to you, the Palestinian struggle, yes. But I think there's a worldwide injustice Which we've got to tackle in which Britain is involved.
What about with the cuts here in Britain? There are people, you know, now who are getting pretty desperate. Some people have virtually no prospect of getting a job, even though they're just out of university, as more and more people are queuing up for fewer and fewer jobs.
Well, you see, I'm still a communist because the injustices which caused people to become communists many, many years ago are still there in abundance. The same old problems, the irrationality of having poverty and unemployment. I love the statement made by Bob Geldof when he was interviewed some years ago. He said, "It makes no sense for anyone to die of want in a world of plenty." And that sums up so much for me. It makes no sense for anyone to die of want in a world of plenty. Why are people dying of want? And here in Britain, a very, very rich country, extremely... I mean, the 1,000 richest people in the UK have got a combined wealth of over £400 billion. We haven't got a problem of lack of money in this country. It's just in the wrong hands. It's not being used for the right purposes.
Ken, just remind us finally then of your book title and where we can get it.
Yes, well, you can get it from any bookshops or online sources. It's called London Recruits... Secret War Against Apartheid.
Ken Keeble, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Hypocrisie dans la politique. Ce n'est pas bon, ce n'est pas bon, nous n'en voulons pas. Démagogie dans la politique. Ce n'est pas bon, ce n'est pas bon, nous n'en voulons pas. La dictature dans la politique. Ce n'est pas bon, ce n'est pas bon, nous n'en voulons pas. Du bonheur ce n'est pas bon, nous n'en voulons pas. Les dictateurs dans la politique. Ce n'est pas bon, ce n'est pas bon, nous n'en voulons pas. Du respect pour le peuple. Yeah, yeah, yeah. De la paix pour le peuple. Oh, 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 oh. Le politique. Machine de guerre, impitoire pour ses ennemis. Il travaille pour lui, en disant qu'il travaille pour nous. Il nous dit merci, en passant, voilà qui est pris. Ce n'est pas bon, ce n'est pas bon.
Dans la politique, ce n'est pas bon, ce n'est pas bon, nous n'en voulons pas. Démagogie dans la politique, ce n'est pas bon, ce n'est pas bon, nous n'en voulons pas. Les dictateurs dans la politique, ce n'est pas bon, ce n'est pas bon, nous n'en voulons pas. We'll be right back.
Commando, and Miriam again with Ce n'est pas bon.